So the two branches of this project, one is looking at the category life. I'm not going to do that today in different religions. And the other is looking at the using the category life, and particularly the category, what I've called bioenergy, in as a way of explaining religions. Now, it's also a commitment to a non-reductionist account of religion as well. So I'll begin my introduction. You should have the handout, which is roughly the structure of what I'm going to speak about. So firstly, the introduction is so a crucial question, really, in contemporary humanities, highly relevant to wider social and political issues, is how do we account for the persistence of religion on the global stage? How do we account for the persistence of religion? Now, in spite of developments of technologies that have transformed communication, in spite of massive secularization in the Western or North Atlantic world, religions persist and are growing in some parts of the world through population increase, but also through missionary activity. And even in what Charles Taylor identified as the secular age, religions continue to be of central importance to identity politics, to nationalism, and to the formation of human meaning in many kinds of spirituality that inform Western democracies. And even China is a burgeoning religious field where religion may well be of central to social transformation in the future. And some people even argue that Christianity will be a majority religion in China in a sort of, 50 years' time or something like that. So that's quite interesting what's happening there. So the task of understanding and explaining religion is of major importance, not only as an area of academic inquiry, but because it has impact upon governance, economics, world politics throughout the world. Now, the explanation of religion in the last 50 years has tended to develop two directions, or two reductionisms, perhaps. A cultural reductionism that understands religion in terms of cultural politics and the performance of politics by other means, and a neurobiological reductionism that understands religion only in terms of an evolutionary neurological processes. So that fellow Pisani, and whatever you pronounce his name, and Pascal Boyer, Scott Atran, that kind of bunch. Now, both of these have proved to be powerful critiques of theological and phenomenological ways of accounting for religion. So you've got these two reductionisms, arguably, in religious studies. One is cultural, that sees religion as ideology, really, as a way of, as Tim Fitzgerald, my old colleague, says, it's a sort of a capitalist plot, really, to subjugate the other. And so religion is seen purely in cultural terms. So religion can't be translated into South Asia or China. It's an emic Western category that has no applicability outside the West, kind of idea. And is also always linked to a politics of representation and power. Foucault is a very important thinker in this. I think he's misused a bit in that, but anyway, he is used there. And the other is this scientific reductionism. Now, but to give an account of the complexity of religion and how it functions in the complexity of world, society, and politics, we need to draw on complex disciplines that offer comprehensive, coherent, and corroborated explanations of human reality. Science arguably holds such a position of privilege in contemporary society, and has done since about the 17th century. Now, science has offered comprehensive accounts of world that are open to empirical investigation and rational inquiry, and has undergone several revolutions itself, or paradigm shifts in its development. While acknowledging that it is difficult to speak of science in general, we might say that the contemporary sciences, particularly biological and neurological sciences, offer understandings of who we are as mind and body in a material world. And these scientific accounts intersect with cultural understandings, and there is an imperative to explain religion in such terms, I would argue. Science has developed technologies that affect embodiment and offers powerful explanations of how humans act and interact. So I wouldn't want to... Somebody said to me, oh, this is just positivism, but I hope it's not positivism, because it is attempting to be non-reductionistic, but taking contemporary science seriously, as all... as academics have done and scholars have done throughout the century. I mean, Descartes took the science of his time very seriously in the construction of his theories and so on. So I think we have an imperative to take contemporary scientific development seriously too. But rather than explanation of social and cultural practices in causal terms, it is more informative, I think, to speak in terms of constraint. As John Bowker has taught us, we need to ask questions about what are the constraints that control an event into its particularity? What is it that makes it the vishesha, that makes it what it is? And causation is too simple, it's too crude to answer that question. So that is, rather than a simplistic model of physical causation, we need to specify the types or levels of constraint that result in a particular outcome. The specification of constraint is crucial to explanation and understanding, and one of the fundamental constraints on human behaviour is our cognition and our neural processes that accompany every mental act. I mean, the brain is the most complex entity in the universe that we know of, which is phenomenal, really. In particular, what has been identified as social cognition is crucial to understanding the nature of the human and therefore the nature of religion. So social cognition, I'm arguing, is very important. So that's my introduction. In the spirit of such inquiry, this essay or this paper, I seek to account for some recent explanations of human interaction in terms of cognition and evolutionary neuroscience. Secondly, to show how social cognition is transformed through religion at a cultural level as system in relation to environment. Religion is a form of what we might call a biosociology. This transformation is echoed in the history of Homo sapiens as a move from sign to symbol. This suggests, thirdly, a philosophical claim that life itself comes to articulation through religion. Religions are the transformation of bioenergy, this is a bit speculative, but expressed at an interpersonal level in human face-to-face encounter that is rearticulated at structurally higher levels as religious systems, comprising practice, doctrine, narrative, and above all, law, which reflexively controls the face-to-face encounter. So religion as biosociology is the transformation of the bioenergy at the level of culture, serving to reflexively control the bioenergy, the bioenergic source of social cognition. So that's basically an outline of the argument. And that was just the introduction. Oh, God. So the face-to-face encounter, we're on the first section now. Now, new work on the cognitive neuroscience has argued that the human face-to-face encounter is fundamental to the development of the evolution of the human species. A recent development focused on what has become known as second-person neuroscience from a research team in Cologne has attempted to understand and explain human social transformation in terms of social neuroscience, which has, quote, has begun to illuminate the complex biological bases of human social cognitive abilities. What is happening at the neurological level has explanatory power for human behaviour. In particular, human social practices and the development of language. Social cognition is a broad field in which brain and social behaviour are linked, and in particular, work on the face-to-face encounter has shown how complex processes of interaction between people are at work even below conscious awareness. They've done work that shows that you've made the decision neurologically before you think you've made the decision. That's quite interesting. In particular, there is a mirroring process at a cellular level that occurs in face-to-face cognition, reflected at higher levels in imitation of gesture, eye movement, and facial expression. So we imitate each other, we reflect and mirror each other. Well, Girard knows this, and he talks about how this happens. It's a negative effect, usually. These very subtle signals have evolved in our species to maximise sociality and thereby ensure optimal survival potential. From these signs, we directly perceive rather than infer information about gender, age, status, and other factors important for decision-making in social situations. From the complexity of information given in the face-to-face encounter, humans have evolved abilities to transform fundamental process into higher forms of cognition and social engagement. The successful building of coalitions, quote, rests in part on the ability to extract and recall the identities of others. And people who attend to faces can establish social control and affiliation. Well, we all know this. It's a, you know, you get into trouble if you don't remember who your relatives are and stuff like that. You know what their names are. Now, this ability to recognize and track emotional responses in the face is established from a very early age in the human infant, in whom the ability to read faces seems to be an innate ability. So it's not learned, it's innate. Babies as young as 30 minutes old can track faces and privilege the mother's face. Eye movements and the gaze in particular are important indicators of group affiliation, and the direction of gaze has been an important factor in establishing a joint focus of attention and in developing trust and social cohesiveness. There is a priority of our face-to-face interactions through which we infer the mental states of others and anticipate their future actions that might be crucial to the success of the group. Work on facial recognition has been going on for a long time. Paul Ekman, who you probably know his work, did preliminary research on the cross-cultural expression of emotion. This is back in the 70s now, showing that six emotional expressions are commonly recognized, namely happiness, sadness, anger, disgust, fear, and surprise. He did these through photographs, but also through people putting on these faces, you know. While fear and surprise are sometimes confused, happiness is not. Happiness is always recognized. It's not confused with other emotional faces. Faces in Ekman's study are a means of social communication. Happy faces signal affiliation to the group. Sad and fearful expressions signal submissiveness, whereas anger signals dominance. That is, the face becomes a sign bearing a social message, and according to the second person account, is always in response to the other within a particular context. The face-to-face encounter is therefore crucial both phylogenetically in the evolution of the culture. It's crucial both phylogenetically in the evolution of culture that stems from group interaction, and the development of what Thomas Sello, the primatologist, calls collective intentionality, and ontogenetically in the infant's ability to become part of the group. So you've got the phylogeny and ontogeny. And this facial recognition is crucial to both. Sloterdijk, our friend Sloterdijk, refers to the human face-to-face as, quote, the species-wide interfacial greenhouse effect. Whatever that means. When we deal with the face-to-face, we're dealing with a fundamental structure of the human. The scientific study of human face-to-face interaction is being developed in second-person neuroscience that through experimental data builds models on how we interact. Schildbach and his colleagues Kai Vogler and others have shown that social cognition entails two networks in the brain, the mirror neuron system that allows us to identify someone as an I, and the what they call the mentalizing system that allows us to understand someone else as a he or a she. But models of cognition based on these two systems that give us the grasp of first and third person accounts are limited because they presuppose the very theoretical framework that they intend to investigate. They presuppose what they're trying to prove. The experiments that demonstrate both the mirror neuron and mentalizing systems are themselves based on an isolationist paradigm in which there is no interaction with those who are being observed. So it's the kind of the detached scientific, you know, you do these experiments on people from behind a screen or with the mirror or something, but there's no interaction between the investigator and the people being investigated. But once you get rid of that and you start investigating on an interpersonal level, then things change. But once interaction between researcher and research takes place, then this produces different results in our neural networks. The significance of this is that social cognition takes place between people, and the very interaction produces differences in brain processing. Schulbach observes, quote, after more than a decade of research, the neural mechanisms underlying social interaction have remained elusive and could paradoxically be seen as representing the dark matter of social neuroscience. The unconscious processes in the brain seen through neuroimaging, which remain outside of conscious awareness. So this dark matter is the area of second-person neuroscience, in which the interaction of people in the face-to-face encounter affects the neurology between them. Now, this way of understanding human cognition through the face-to-face encounter means that the older model of the theory of mind, TOM, T-O-M, TOM, whereby we impute mental states to others analogically due to our own, is in error or fundamentally mistaken because it is based on a questionable mind-body dualism. TOM entails an inference of other minds from behaviour. This is Husserl as well, so you infer the other. There's a body a bit like mine, and you infer that over there there's another person like me here, sitting here. So he uses this, I think he says Dardruba, over there, you know. So that's Tom. But now, rather than a theory of mind, Schulbach again, we do not need to impute consciousness to others if we directly perceive the qualities of consciousness in the qualities of action. We don't have to infer. But then you've got philosophical problems. What about a robot and so on? Anyway, the second person approach, however, shows that understanding of other minds is not inferred, but rather a direct response embodied in social interaction, in which the brains themselves are mutually changed through the interpersonal encounter. The individual brain is part of a dynamic process, and the neuroscientists De Pauli and De Jager have proposed that an interactive brain hypothesis, IBH, is more adequate to the data than the mind reading of Tom. So that was only 2012 they were proposing this idea, this IBH, which does make sense to me. The brain alone is not enough to account for social cognition. We need to take into account bodies in interaction that enact world through the face-to-face encounter that has developed in human social evolution. That is, the body plays a role in the formation of brain mechanisms that are shaped by persons in interaction rather than simply passively receiving inputs and processing social interactions. Such an enactment model provides empirical support for philosophical positions long since held about the embodied nature of human experience in people such as Varela. Earlier in the last century, Merleau-Ponty's work on the body as an instrument or field of perception, giving access to a creating world. Second-person neuroscience then develops three aspects of social interaction. Firstly, any situation of interaction involves an initiator and a respondent. Secondly, that within the interactive context, new shared intentions arise, shared intentions. And thirdly, interaction always entails that social situations have to be understood in relation to a past. So collective memory is very important. That is, human interactions entail communication, minimally a sender and a receiver, and such interaction entails the development, minimally, of joint intentionality, and but beyond this, to shared or collective intentionality. Tomasello has argued through experimentation with pre-linguistic children and higher primates that human children are born with the innate tendency towards altruism, or to be more specific, what he calls mutualism, in which we benefit from cooperation, the tendency to help others without any immediate reward for the self. So he did experiments. So you've got a bunch of, you know, kids, pre-linguistic children in a room, and he sets up experiences. An adult comes in with a pile of pots or books and is struggling, and the pre-linguistic children would go to help the adult, you know, through the door, which is quite sweet, really. But also they'll give sweets to each other, even if there's no advantage to themselves. If the other child hasn't got a sweet, then they've got one. Not all of them, but some of them will give the other children their sweet, you know. So this is kind of spontaneous altruism that occurs, which is, Tomasello argues, is biologically based and is. And that this develops into, and part of this is this develops into collective intentionality and sociality. And linked to that is the notion of pointing. So pre-linguistic children point. And Tomasello argues that this indexicality is the beginnings of language, that is fundamental to the way language develops. And that's why we have white eyes evolutionarily, because we point with our eyes. We're the only species apparently that has such dominant white in our eyes through pointing with our eyes, which is an indication of a shared collective intentionality. Apes, he says, are don't do that. Apes are apes can be taught to point, but they don't point independently. And they can be taught to give their banana to another ape, as long as there's something in it for them, like a bigger banana or something. there's no altruism, he argues, in the higher apes. There's another anthropologist, who argues against that. So I don't know. But anyway, Tomasello's arguments are interesting, regardless of whether apes are altruistic or not. Now, second person. While the origins of language are still being debated, what is clear is that to facilitate this mutualism, we need to develop a mode of communication beyond the here and now. Second-person neuroscience shows us the ways in which we interact in the face-to-face encounter that, in a group situation, becomes intensely complex, particularly through eye contact and other expressions, which can be seen in neuroimaging. Our faces imitate each other, as do our brains, through neural coupling, through which we are able to make judgments about the trustworthiness of members of the group. Making judgments in complexity has been crucial for Homo sapiens as a species, and judgments occur initially below consciousness. In interactivity, the brains of all participants are affected, and this process constitutes a material reality beyond individual participants. How then is all this relevant to religion, you might well ask? Now, to answer this question, we need to introduce new terminology that links the biosociology of the face-to-face encounter with higher-level cognitive abilities, namely language, and broader historical processes. We might claim that Sloterdijk's species-wide greenhouse effect of the face-to-face encounter is the articulation of what we might call what might be called bioenergy, the power of life itself coming to articulation through social cognition that has material or physical effects on the brains and behaviours of social actors. The bioenergy of the face-to-face is transformed or recapitulated in religion as a higher level system that then feeds back to the face-to-face encounter, controlling social interactions, particularly through law. While the face-to-face is clearly a system of communication, what marks Homo sapiens communication is language. It is all very well focusing on social cognition as face-to-face interaction, but it is human communication through language where distinctively human capacities come into play, and in which we see the transformation of the face-to-face into a higher order sphere of collective intentionality rather than individual intentionality or joint intentionality. You get this collective intentionality developing. The social cognition of the pre-linguistic face-to-face encounter is arguably the root of language, that is, the precondition for religion. Indeed, we might say that the face-to-face encounter as index becomes articulated as sign in language, which then undergoes a further transformation as symbol in religion. So there's this move from index through sign to symbol. And that's a shift in human development to notions of religion. The transformations of social cognition from index to symbol occurs through the plasticity of the brain. The human brain responds rapidly to changing events and grows or diminishes in relation to particular situations. This plasticity is linked to memory, that is intrinsic to close relationships and intrinsic to symbolic or distantiated communication. Memory comes to play an important role in human face-to-face encounters and is intrinsic to such relationships. Transposed to the cultural level, we see the plasticity of the brain operating in personal identity, the sameness of who we are through time, or idem identity, and in what Ricoeur has called narrative identity, or ipse, the cultural formation of the person in relation to others. These two kinds of identity, idem and ipse, are important for the formation of human persons in providing a sense of sameness that links to the past and a sense of narrative and directionality that links to the future. Both are crucial in the formation of human meaning. As humans, we need being, the personal identity or sense of unchanging identity, and becoming, the potential for change and the selfhood that entails narrative. The transformation of the micro level of the face-to-face at the macro-cultural level occurs through personal and narrative identity, both of self and of community. A person's narrative identity is particularly formed by communities to which he or she belongs, and the sense of being part of a story bigger than the self. Religions have traditionally located person in community, which has traditionally extended from the human to the cosmological entities, to gods, angels and demons. The forms of idem and ipse identity are therefore generated at the cultural level in ritual that transforms or establishes idem identity, and through ipse that is formed in the narratives of tradition, and above all in law, where its implementation occurs through enactment, through the body. The somatic exploration that constitutes the practices of religion and experiences of transcendence that have served to facilitate human evolutionary development. So idem and ipse are crucial to identity formation and are crucial to understanding what religions are. And religions have strong investment in both kinds of identity. And you could even say that fundamentalism was a confusion of the two, was a taking an ipse identity as an idem identity. I think that's probably analytically true, but whether that could have any effect at all on policy, I don't know. How do you change? You don't, can't go to IS and say, "Oh yeah, your problem is you're confusing an idem identity." And they wouldn't be taken seriously. So I don't know how you translate Ricoeur's kind of insight into policy. I think that's an interesting issue. But anyway, both idem and ipse, I think, are grounded in fundamental human social cognition, and particularly I'd like to highlight the face-to-face. And in this too, so I'm now moving on to my second section. I won't have time to do all of this, so I'll just talk through some of it. So now, for index to autopoiesis. Now, to begin an account of this shift, we need to explicate and clarify as best we can a number of terms, and to offer some reflection on the shift from what we might call indexicality to structurally higher forms of communication through language and symbol. Our central claim is that religions can be explained and understood as transformations of the bioenergy that finds expression in the face-to-face encounter. They go beyond the face-to-face and reflexively control it. Religions go beyond the face-to-face but reflexively control the face-to-face. This is an empirical claim within the horizon of evolutionary theory, that religions have developed by building on human potentialities for survival and intra-species communication. It is also a philosophical or theoretical claim about meaning and the articulation of life. The general position I wish to arrive at is that we can understand religions as higher-level transformations of bioenergy that are meaningful. That is, religions bring the bioenergy of the face-to-face into the realm of meaning and therefore of language. In that transformation, we see a shift from systems of communication that are indexical to systems of communication that are signal, what we might call signal, through signs and symbols, that are not ostensive in any way, not pointing, not ostensive. Indeed, we might see religions as particular kinds of symbol systems, as Geertz claims, that function as autopoetic systems that are transformations of social cognition. But to arrive at this point, we need to unpack the conceptual development from indexicality to sign to symbol, and to examine the ways in which the index, the sign, and the symbol signify meaning. These abstract notions must be related to human practices, for if they are anything, religions are above all systems of practice. Our first question concerns the meaningfulness of the face-to-face encounter. The answer to this question partly depends upon what kind of communication event the face-to-face encounter is. On the one hand, if we take meaning as arising within non-linguistic context, then the face-to-face encounter that is primarily non-linguistic could be meaningful, as animal communication could therefore be meaningful. If, however, we restrict meaning to linguistic contexts, to utterance, then the face-to-face encounter is a different kind of communication. One approach to this problem might be to begin with the old structuralist definition of index, sign and symbol that are still helpful. In a somewhat overlooked book, Edmund Leach defines an index as something that indicates something else in a non-arbitrary relationship. A indicates B, a smoke indicates fire. Whereas a signum that comprises two subsets of signs, sign and symbol, A stands for B as a result of an arbitrary human choice. On this account, the difference between a sign and a symbol is one of metonymy and metaphor. On the one hand, a sign bears a metonymic relationship to what it signifies, as a crown is a sign of royalty. On the other, a symbol bears a metaphoric relationship to what it signifies, as a snake is purely metaphorical, i.e. arbitrary symbol of evil. Leaving aside the question of whether Leach's scheme is credible, it is useful for our purposes in sharpening the nature of the face-to-face communication in relation to language. Clearly, a face can be all of these, but the first question we need to address is whether the face-to-face encounter is an index or a signum. So really, that's what I'm trying to get at. Is it an index or a signum? It could be argued that the primary relationship of the face-to-face encounter is an index. That is, it indicates communicativity between two or more persons, a communication field that can be filled out with different contexts, but primarily filled with the six modes of emotional expression identified by Ekman. The face-to-face, in its pre-linguistic form, is not a signum because it points to nothing other than itself, to nothing other than the encounter of two or more persons, even when there could be a shared intentionality arising within that encounter. The shared intentionality is within or part of social cognition. In its bare primate form, the face-to-face is a pre-linguistic mode of communication, an index of group belonging and trustworthiness, as we have seen, and so stands outside of meaning if we wish to restrict meaning to language, and therefore to signum, as arguably we should. If human behaviour, as Leach argues, can be divided into natural activity of the body, such as breathing and metabolic system, technical actions that alter the physical world, such as digging a hole, and expressive actions that wish to say something about the world, then language functions in both technical and expressive senses. It is in the expressive sense that language is symbolic, and the primacy of the pre-linguistic face-to-face is transformed through language into communication that ensures the practical, more effective realization of shared goals, and into communication that transforms language into a symbolic role. There is a remarkable sociality facilitated through language that is unparalleled in all other species. Even though the face-to-face encounter is fundamental to human sociality, language has transformed the force of this bioenergy such that language is shared, and yet it points to me, the possessor of language, at the same time. It recognises in its very structure relationality and the inevitable sociality of the human alongside the subjectivity that claims language, that claims an indexical I as pointing to me, and that claims the deixic here to indicate my present location in and time. As Luhmann observes, language can be used psychically as well as communicatively. In the dialectic between system and person, language plays a crucial role. Language in general is part of system, yet language is particular and belongs to me as speech. If the indexicality of the face-to-face forms collectivities through shared plasticity of the brain that changes in the interactive moment, then indexicality in language itself, pragmatic indexicality, serves to individuate language, to give its particular voice my voice. We might say that the language transforms index, pointing with eye or finger, into sign, where pointing becomes substituted by a linguistic marker indicating particular persons, places and times. The sign becomes a defining feature of language beyond the non-linguistic index, in which the sign designates that which it means in the context of the use of a particular language. In one sense, then, language serves to distance us from the face-to-face encounter through the ability to abstract and project into past and future, although in another sense it enhances social cognition through articulating thought about action. What should we do now? What direction should we go in? Where will we find shelter? As Ricoeur has remarked, on the one hand, language as identifying reference tells us about world. On the other, language as speech act changes world. Indeed, for Ricoeur, language is the link between agent and action, and therefore world. And Ricoeur is helpful in explaining these issues. So anyway, Ricoeur, as we know, he goes on about... So you've got definite descriptions like the first man on the moon, you've got proper names such as Felix the Cat, and you've got indexicals such as Are You Here Now? And those are a significant dimensions of language. So I'm going to whiz through this material. The other thing about language evolutionarily is that it restricts meaning, that... Well, it's interesting that there's one. Luhmann argues that meaning is through our interactions with the world, we receive such an overwhelming amount of information from the world that language is necessary to block out and to the consciousness, which is linked to language, blocks out information coming from the world. So it's a restrictive, it narrows down the range of meanings open to us, because otherwise we couldn't have survived for so long. We'd be so overwhelmed. You have to make instantaneous decisions. Like, you know, you see a shadow and you duck because it's a saber-toothed tiger or something like that. Language will get in the way of those kind of responses. So why am I saying this? Sorry, I've suddenly lost my thread. Language in the level... But that's a restriction of meaning when speaking about world, but language transformed in religion is actually an opening out of new kinds of meaning through imagination. Sorry, I don't have time to develop all of these things here. All the bit that I've just missed out is about Luhmann. Luhmann he's dead now, was a German sociologist who argued, taking Varela and Maturana's notion of autopoiesis, which is a self-regulating system, argue that we can show that society is an autopoetic system, and he distinguishes between system as autopoiesis and what he calls psychic system, which is persons, and there's a structural coupling between the two. And he wrote one of his last books on religion as system, and I thought it was quite interesting because you can see religions as autopoetic systems in a sense. Now, what's an interesting question is how those autopoetic systems can be understood as transformations of social cognition. And I think we can show that, and that those autopoetic systems then reflexively turn back on social cognition to control it through practices, narratives, and laws. So religion, we could say, is a realm of meaning distinct from the ambient environmental world that it simplifies. In creating a boundary between itself and the infinitely complex world, and also, one might add, infinitely complex person, structural coupling between system and environment, which Luhmann goes on about, allows for the control of environment through religious law that controls the environment of persons and controls the environment of world, through regulating the modes of its technological manipulation. Religions tell us how to dispose of the dead, how to grow food, what technologies are acceptable and not acceptable. Luhmann himself has written on systems theory of religion. His question is, in his book, is what lets us recognise religion? What lets us recognise religion? And his answer is that we recognise religion as a form of communication, as a code for dealing with complexity, that functions as a differentiated social system of providing meaning, and so the reduction of complexity. Meaning for Luhmann is the reduction of complexity. This, in many ways, is a compelling account in that religion must be distinguished from environment, functioning as a realm of meaning to reduce complexity. But there are problems with it. One of Luhmann's theoretical goals is to replace an account of religion in terms of humanity with an account of it in terms of communication, thereby replacing a theory of religion centred on anthropology with one centred on society. Indeed, one might think link autopoiesis with the bioenergy of the face-to-face relation, insofar as such autonomous system nevertheless derives its power from the biological interaction. Religion, on this account, is a biosociology, and I think that is correct. Now, to recap our findings so far, 5 more minutes. In human evolution, the primary social encounter has been face-to-face social cognition that we experience in the present, but that reaches deep into our hominid past, the importance of which we can appreciate ontogenetically in the development of children's social capacities, even in newly born infants. This capacity for sociality, expressed through indices of bonding, such as facial expression and pointing, becomes transformed with the development of language into a system of signification that can recapitulate the past and project a future. So the here and now deixis, the indexicality of language, gets transformed into the ability to recapitulate the past and project a future in imagination. With the system of signs, i.e. the arising of language, we have a further development of more complex signification through symbol, the ability of language to represent complexity by creating group narrative and by creating a system of acceptable behaviour conducive to the common good, or at least conducive to the ruling elites, that we might call law. Moreover, such systems of signification are never purely abstract, but encoded in forms of action. Stories are told and laws are enforced, above all self-enforced. We might say that religion is a mode of group sociality that transforms the bioenergy of the face-to-face into higher-level signifying systems of narrative and law that reflexively control the face-to-face encounter. Thus, with religion, we have an emphasis on identity and group belonging that is reinforced through strict laws of human interaction. Religions are deeply concerned with reproduction, who we can and cannot have sexual relationships with, and with alimentation, what we can and cannot eat. While some religions are more concerned with these things than others, we think of Judaism and Islam on kosher food and halal food, Hinduism, Jainism, Sikhism on vegetarianism, caste systems and codes of sexual morality in Buddhism and Christianity, all religions seek to control these fundamental modes of human interaction and survival. The control of food and sex through religious law has been crucial to the modification of human sociality and the development of civilization. There's echoes of Freud, perhaps, in this idea. Freud says civilization is a transformation of the sublimation of the instincts, and perhaps there was some insight there when he says that. But he's on the horns of a dilemma, Freud, of course, because on the one hand, we're unhappy because we sublimate the instincts, and yet there's civilization because of the sublimation of the instincts. So it's a tragic view of life, which I don't really share. So religions have been extraordinarily successful as transformations of human bioenergy into culture, more successful than the smaller social unit of the family that is necessarily restricted to an immediate environment, more successful than social units such as the tribe or clan, and more successful than the more recent nationalisms that are restricted to a particular geographical location. Secular ideologies can and have functioned as transformations of social cognition. And so the remit of religious studies is not simply restricted to what we have traditionally understood as religions, but extends to other patterns of social and political transformation, whose forms are complex in complex contemporary societies. Religions and their analogues provide us with an elaborate social apparatus through ritual and ethical codes expressed as law and that sustain the vulnerability of the face-to-face while at the same time transforming this into a corporate identity that often defines itself in relation to other corporate identities. Now, there are philosophical implications to what I've just said that I won't go into, and I'll just conclude. In sum, then, to return to our opening question, how can we account for the persistence of religion? we can say that religions are still forms of life that give meaning to human communities and provide ways of living and dying. They form and influence life in the unrepeatable nature of the ethical act. They constrain people's choices and in the non-identical repetition of the ritual act. So there's the unrepeatable nature of the ethical act, because you have to, because your decision, you make an ethical judgment, which is unrepeatable. And on the other hand, the ritual act is repeatable, repeated all the time. I think ethical acts are unrepeatable. Anyway, that the churches are emptying in much of Northern Europe does not indicate the demise of religion. Indeed, analogous forms of culture will inevitably develop that lay claim to the face-to-face and attempt to control social cognition. Of course, other societal patterns can do this. Even secular practices of socialization, such as sport or the shared experience of plastic art or music. But only religions are cultural forms with historical depth and semantic density that to date have successfully negotiated and developed the primacy of the human encounter. It seems to be the case that other forms of cultural life are developing in which people choose different aspects of religion to engage with, and people might participate in more than one religion in the modern world. If religions are central to human communities because they stem from life itself and effectively control social cognition, then religious studies as a critical discipline is crucial for understanding these cultural forms, both in terms of cognition and processes in the brain that accompany religious activity, and in terms of cultural production and the representation of communities and people. So that's my